And good morning. Welcome to Cool Science Radio, science and technology in a complicated world that's interesting, fun, and understandable. I'm John Wells. I'm here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peake. Our first guest this morning is Eric Ide, University of Utah Research Assistant Professor of Computer Science. University of Utah computer scientists have developed software that not only detects and eradicates never-before-seen viruses and other malware, but also automatically repairs damage caused by them. The software then prevents the invader from ever infecting the computer again. If there are any Sony executives listening in, don't jump. Help is on the way.
Good morning, John. Our second guest this morning is Cory Doctorow. He's the author of Information Doesn't Want to Be Free. Doctorow takes on the state of copyright and creative success in the digital age. Can small artists still thrive in the internet era? Can giant record labels avoid alienating their audiences? This is a book about the pitfalls and the opportunities that creative industries and individuals are confronting today, and how the old models have failed or found new footing, and about what might soon replace them.
These two guests plus today's very cool story when we return. You're listening to Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Emmy Award-winning actress, comedian, and singer Jane Lynch delivers a side-splitting, anti-cabaret cabaret show New Year's Eve at the Eccles Center. Unconventional, uproarious, thoroughly entertaining, the evening with Jane Lynch starts at 8 p.m. Tickets start at $40. Call 655-3114. Here's to a new year filled with laughter and song. Brought to you by the not-for-profit Park City Institute, entertaining, educating, and illuminating since 1998, and a KPCW supporter.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peake. Our first guest is Eric Ide, University of Utah Research Assistant Professor of Computer Science. Eric's team at the university, along with Raytheon Bolt Beranek Newman, have developed a unique piece of software for fighting hackers. Now, normally, antiviral software that might be on your PC compares a catalog of known viruses to something that has infected the computer. Well, Ide software is different. It's named A3. It can detect new unknown viruses by sensing that something's wrong, and then it stops the virus, approximates a repair for the damaged software code, and then it learns to never let the culprit return. Eric Ide, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, how are you this morning?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Yeah, we're up here. We got some flurries blowing here in Park City. Beautiful day. Your software just sounds like a very unique approach to a problem that we're all talking about. Can you describe it to us, sort of for the layperson?
Sure. Well, I'll give it a go. So to start, this A3 it's a sort of an acronym for Advanced Adaptive Applications, and this was research supported by DARPA under what was called the CRASH program, which was a program to develop clean slate, resilient, adaptive, secure hosts. Right. So the idea was to take a new look at computer security and come up with lots of ideas for better protecting computers. And of course, DARPA is very interested in protecting military computers. So.
And DARPA is Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency.
Yeah. They fund a lot of computer science research on a lot of topics. So. Anyway, but this particular program was about improving security and doing research towards that end. And so the A3 project sort of started with the premise that software is always going to have bugs, right? So we've been writing computer software for a long time now, and it seems that computer software always has bugs, and you always have to, you're installing updates and so on and so on. So, our software and our computers are just never going to be perfect. Right. So given that, right, I mean, we can strive to make them perfect, but knowing that we'll just never get there, right, what is it that we can do to improve the situation? And so what A3 was about essentially was creating a container that could basically be wrapped around an application, right? And this container is basically sort of our defense, right? We're going to we're not going to modify the application itself, okay? But we're going to have a container that we can put around lots of different applications, and this container is what's going to help us, you know, keep the bad guys out and, you know, the good stuff in, right? And you can sort of look at it in two ways, right? So the container, right, gives you an inside and an outside, right? So from the outside, what we want to do is prevent viruses and other sorts of attacks from coming in, right? So if we organize our container so that we can monitor all of the inputs and outputs to the application, we can decide whether to let those things in or block them, right?
Right.
And also from looking at it, you know, at the inside of the container, we can look at what's going on within that scope. So we can use a technique called introspection to look inside the container, monitor the application state, and see whether or not we think that it's healthy, right? The other division that I wanted to make here, this was, so Crash was about adaptive security, right? So another two aspects to this project. So first, the idea was that the container was supposed to provide some innate security, right? So it would be built in, right? We could, if we knew things that we wanted to defend against, right, we can protect those. So, or, you know, we can defend against those things, right? And that can just be built in. But at the same time, we're also interested in identifying threats that we've never seen before. These are what are sometimes called zero days or things like that, right? And so the idea is that, you know, if we discover, for instance, that some input has made our application sick, something, you know, we allowed it through and it put us in a bad state, okay, the idea is that we want to, first, we want to get back in a good state, so we want to repair ourselves. And second, we also want to try and diagnose what happened so that we can then be resistant to that in the future, right? So in just a few minutes, that's sort of what A3 was about.
Well, that's quite a description. Sounds like a sophisticated.
Yeah, it was a 4-year research project, and we were busy throughout that time. So you know, there are a lot of moving parts in this, right? But you know, altogether, you know, I think we did some good work in advancing sort of the state of the art, right?
And what is NSA's response to the September announcement? Have they responded at all?
I think I'm a little bit confused about that question. So NSA is not involved in the A3 project,
right? But they amass zero-day programs, and they're always out there combing to see what's out there in the defense of cyber warfare, and they're very
in tune. I have to say that so NSA has not talked to me about the A3 project. If one of your listeners is with the NSA and they want to give me a call,
here's your number.
There's my number. You can find me on Google, right? So, but anyway, I mean anyway, like you said, the goal of the A3 research project was to be able to, I mean, test some new ways of providing computer security, because, you know, it seems that, you know, sort of our current techniques are not functioning as well as they should. You know, I mean, it's not sufficient to just scan for known viruses looking for particular signatures. It's not easy to identify this code, and so what we need to do is be able to look at what our programs are doing and have basically be able to introspect on them, have something that not is just saying, you know, what is this piece of code, but what is that piece of code doing, right? And one, be able to react to things like that, and then, you know, be able to dynamically develop defenses, right, as opposed to waiting for your security software vendor to send you, you know, the daily updates or something like that, right?
So. Right. Our guest is Eric Ide from the University of Utah. He's a computer scientist there and has just completed a 4-year research project that is kind of an innovative solution to, or the next step maybe in internet security and or computer security. And I want to just say, Eric, you know, we've spoken a lot on this program recently about, you know, international cyber warfare. And I'm going to tell you that what I'm hearing here is going to help me to sleep a little better at night, I think, because of what you're doing, the advances that you're making. And what it sounds like to me is that this system is both, as you explained, both proactive and reactive. Would mm-hmm. that be a fair assessment?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Good. So you explained it really well. I can tell you're a professor that must deal with students. So it, using the idea of a container is a very good analogy. But let's go back for those of our listeners who are whose heads are spinning right now. Let's go back to, you know, the types of viruses and malware and bugs and Trojans that are that invade our computers. Talk a little bit about how they get there and what, up until this point, are the ways they've been protected.
Okay,
computer.
So there are many kinds of malware. Lots of words for describing them, right? I mean, you describe them sort of malware and drive-by downloads and viruses and worms and Trojans and things like that. And you can think of them sort of all as software that is not really acting, you know, in your interest, right?
Yeah.
And these days, malware generally has two goals, right? Or it has one of two goals. The first is to make use of your computer resources, right? So somebody wants to send spam, right? And if you're going to send spam, you need computers to do that because, you know, once a computer starts sending spam, you know, somebody will eventually notice and stop it from sending spam. So you have to continually acquire new computers to if you want to do this, right? So one goal of malware is to take over your resources and use them for whatever purposes they want. And the second one is to steal your personal information, right? Where they typically want credit cards or other identifying information, and then they leverage that, right? Common malware is typically spread through techniques like, you know, sort of malformed documents, right, that you might receive from email. And this is, you know, it's often from people that you don't know, but, you know, sometimes it could be from somebody who you do know, and they say, oh, here's this funny here's this funny Word document, or, you know, here's an Excel spreadsheet that somebody gave to me, and somehow, you know, the document is particularly engineered to take advantage of a defect in something like Microsoft Word or Excel or your, you know, your web browser or whatever, and that's sort of they take advantage of this programming bug, right, to cause essentially to hijack Microsoft Word or Excel or whatever and run the code that they want, right? And the other way that malware is often spread is by visiting websites that might have been compromised and are sort of engineered to deliver malware along with the content, mm-hmm. right? That's a common way of distributing malware. But in some sense, right, it's sort of like, you know, getting a Word document in email. It's just that, you know, typically if you get your Word document, you have to double click on the document or, you know, run it or do whatever. Whereas when you go to a website, you know, you're already sort of requesting the web document, right? So it's coming to you. So those are the common ways that malware gets in. The current defenses, right, tend to be about, you know, they tend to be signature based. Right, which is about, you know, the security software vendors have these large catalogs of viruses that are known, right? Mm-hmm. And they essentially look for this particular kind of code, right? Or, you know, they look for this code on the computer, and when it's discovered, they quarantine it or delete it or do whatever, right?
And that's where A3 is different.
Yeah, so A3, well, so part of the innate defense of a container, right, is that you can include things like that. I mean, if you know that a particular website is dangerous or something like that, you certainly, you know, having a container to sort of, you know, block that you know, you can put that there, right? But it's also, as I said, about, you know, observing the application's health as it runs, right? Having a separate monitor and knowing something. I mean, having some sort of application-specific information about, you know, when the application is good and when it's not, right? So, for instance, you know, if you know that Microsoft Word is supposed to be reading Word documents and it's only supposed to be reading Word documents and it's not supposed to be, you know, messing around with your operating system files, right? That's a policy that you can encode using a system like A3, and you can watch for this kind of behavior, and then when that behavior occurs, you say, well, that's not allowed, right? And you can also check for the effects of these things, right? So, for instance, if you know that the operating system is supposed to have, you know, all of, you know, this kind of code in it, right? And you know exactly what that code is, A3 can you know, from sort of outside the container, A3 can look inside, look at the operating system that's running within the container, right? And it's running a separate operating system inside the container, and we can assess whether or not this application or the operating system is in a good state or in a bad state, not just in terms of its integrity, but also in terms of things we would like to know about its internal data structures, right? Basically, right. The information about what other programs are running and what files are open and things like that, right? And then. In addition, right, so the last thing about once you've identified that you're unhealthy, right, the other part of it is repairing it, you know, getting back on good footing, right, and that's another part of what A3 seeks to do.
Sure. So just a couple of comments. One, when you're talking about ways that computers get infected, you can be very diligent about only opening emails from trusted sources, but what happens oftentimes, or it's happening increasingly, is that hackers go in and they steal contact databases, and then they send an email as if it was coming from you with the malware or the infected product. So that's one thing. The other comment I wanted to make for our users is that this was just announced in September. It is not commercially available yet. It is only in the Linux operating environment. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. So okay. let me just echo what you said. So A3 is a project, right? So we did not make a product that is for sale or whatever. It is open source, right? So if somebody wants to download the source code, play around with it, they're welcome to do that.
Right.
But you would need to be a computer scientist in order to really make use of that, right? I think that's the wanted to say about that.
So for our listeners, open source, again, is something that is freely available for modification or for redistribution. And so I have a question about that. The factors that went into deciding to release A3 to open source, because one of the questions that I had was, are you concerned that by making the source code available to anybody, that hackers will find a way to make A3 ineffective, or a way to kill an A3 environment?
Yeah, well, actually, that's really an interesting question, and I think we're not especially concerned about that, right? So, I mean, the first thing is, of course, is that, you know, A3, like I said, is not a product, right? So we're not, nobody is using A3 in a production environment today.
No, but so, people will productize what you have provided. People
right.
will productize it. There's no question about it.
Right.
I mean, you don't doubt that, do you?
No.
Would be your hope, essentially.
Yeah, we'd be very glad to help people who are interested in our technology turn that into, you know, move that into products, right? But I think, so it, ultimately, having the source code available is not really that much help to a hacker. Right, to somebody who wants to defeat your system, right? Because in order for, well, basically a sophisticated attacker, right, who could get, say, A3, you know, in binary form, right, they can also look at the machine instructions and figure out what it's doing, right? So there's a, you know, I mean, the code has to be, you know, installed and available, and people get these things. they reverse engineer them and, you know, do this sort of thing, right? So starting with source code, you know, it's certainly, you know, I mean, it's helpful for understanding it, but we're not really protecting any secrets, you know, that couldn't be obtained in some other way, right? Mm-hmm. And of course, and then lastly, right, I just want to stress that our job at the University of Utah, right, is to publish research, right? And so we're very, you know, eager to write papers about what we're doing and make our software available so that other people can inspect it and improve upon it and build upon it or turn, you know, incorporated, you know, move technologies into product. And our job is to make things available, right? So that's another, you know, strong incentive for us to use open source whenever we can.
So putting the source code out there then, are there other institutions, other universities that, you know, are doing something different than, say, the University of Utah, such that they would take that code and, you know, modify it or, like you say, build upon it, refine it in some way that they specialize in that the University of Utah doesn't?
That's our hope. This is a great way that researchers collaborate across institutions, right? Mm-hmm. You know, so of course, if somebody just approached me and, you know, from, I don't know, let's say MIT, right? Somebody, oh, I read your paper about the A3 system. Can you send me a copy of the software? Of course, I would just send it to them, right? But, you know, having it available, right, on sort of our website, right, is a way to get collaborations, you know, without them having to ask for it, right? And this, and it turns out that that's a really powerful way to find collaborators, right, that you didn't know existed.
It's kind of like crowdsourcing, which is a great way to put it out there and get people to work on it. But, you know, I'm kind of curious about if you have some sort of intellectual copyright on it, or, you know, do you, once it gets productized, do you get the credit for it?
Ultimately, we would get some credit for it, right? So the University of Utah, probably, as you know, has a whole office, you know, devoted to handling issues of, you know, intellectual property and commercialization and things like that. So they, you know, mostly, you know, they work those things out. A3 does have, it is copyrighted by us, but still the copyright means that you get to decide, you know, how people can distribute it and consume it in some sense, right? And we decide to give it away as open source, right? We would get some credit for it. Yeah.
Okay. So as you sort of put this out there, are there private institutions that, or not institutions, private interests that have grabbed this? And I am thinking the NSA, like John was saying, but, or, you know, or some governmental agency that says, hey, we want to take this and turn it into, you know, a real product that can protect military applications, or even companies that are large servers.
Well, so our partners in the A3 project, we worked with a company called Raytheon BBN Technologies, right?
Right.
And they were our collaborators throughout the project, and they are interested, of course, in turning, you know, using this in some of their internal technologies and products that they mostly sell, I think, to the government, right? I have not been approached in September about somebody said, oh, hey, you know, I want to turn this into a product. Of course, you know, people can Google me and find out. You know, if I'm waiting to take your call, I guess. DARPA funded this, right, and they're interested, of course, in utilizing this sort of technology or other, you know, security-enhancing technologies in the future, right? But, you know, the goal of a research project ultimately is to sort of vet the ideas and take risks and explore things and, you know, push the limits, right, where, you know, there's a transition thing that has to happen after the research ends and a real product or deployment or something like that begins, right? So, I mean, what I'm saying is that somebody it wouldn't make a whole lot of sense for somebody to just download the open source version of it and start selling it, right? Because it's not ready to be a product. It would still take some work. So.
Eric, anytime we have somebody on to talk about cyber warfare or antivirus software, those sorts of things, we always kind of push off topic just a little bit and ask them their opinion if they had any advice for our listeners that basically have Macs or Microsoft environments. What advice can you give us on how to protect our data?
Probably the number one thing that people can do is to stay up to date with their software patches and things like that, right? So when you get a notice and your operating system tells you that, you know, Flash, there's an update to Flash, or there's an update to Microsoft Office, or there's a service pack for Windows, right? You should click on the button, find a convenient time in your workflow, right? But do the upgrade, right? A lot of upgrades are, some of them, sometimes they add features, right? But a lot of times they improve the security of the software. And this is important, right? Because pretty much every PC and every mobile device is connected to the network essentially all the time, you know, now. And so you want to stay up to date, right? And, you know, the internet evolves pretty quickly. And so, number one, staying up to date, right? Second is probably there's a lot of good hygiene, right? That's possible, right? Sort of, and this is advice I think probably your listeners have heard before, where if you get an email from somebody you don't know, telling you that you've inherited $10 million, and or you've won the Irish lottery or something like that, it's probably not true, and you should probably not, open that document, right? Because that probably is a scam, right? I mean, I think sort of healthy skepticism, right, is a good attitude to take, right? when you get a strange email. And then beyond that, there's other good advice, such as using strong passwords, using good passwords, not using the same password for every web service that you might have. And I realize that this is, the password stuff is difficult advice to take because people have a difficult time remembering 100 different passwords or things like that, right? But there are password managers and
so you're a fan
things
of
that can help
of,
things
single.
That can help you with that, right? But sort of as a person who just needs to maintain a PC or something like that, I think probably the number one piece of advice I would give is to try to keep up to date with the updates of the operating system and the applications that you use.
So you're a fan of the single password, of the programs that scramble the password on a regular basis. I mean, the average person has like 30 passwords. So
yeah, well, I think if you don't use them, right? I mean, ultimately, if you don't use them, people forget them, right? And so what happens is that people write them down inevitably, right? And if you're going to do that, right, then you probably need to protect the file in which you've stored all those passwords. So there are these password managers and things like that. And there's also, there are other interesting utilities like things that will make up very strong passwords for you, right? And those can be useful too, right?
And as far as your first piece of advice, which is excellent, of course, staying up to date, I just want to mention to our listeners, if you're tired of getting hassled about all these updates, you can always configure your computer through the settings for automatic updates and take the hassle out of it. So,
yeah, there are quite a few systems will do automatic updates now, right? And so that I think that is very good advice for most people.
Eric Ide, University of Utah Research Assistant Professor of Computer Science, with a fascinating product, A3. We want to thank you so much for being on Cool Science Radio this morning.
Thank you. It's been a real treat talking with you.
Yeah. Something I wanted to mention and that I didn't, I just want to mention it quickly. The that your test at the end was to see if it could detect a known virus, a heck of a virus called shell shock, and your program not only detected it but repaired the computer. I mean, it was a real successful test.
That was do I have time to describe that at all?
Probably about 30 seconds. We got to scoot,
okay.
But please.
Okay. Well, let me just see if I can do this very quickly. So at the end of the program, we created a security exploit, you know, for our own research purposes that used this bug called shell shock, and it was a big deal essentially back in September. It just announced, and so we created an exploit that used this bug on the system that we were trying to protect, and A3 could detect the exploit, and within about 4 minutes, it came up with a way to protect the system. I mean, it figured out that something bad had gone on, and it found a way to protect the system to prevent future uses of that bug. And like I said, it took about 4 minutes.
Wow.
So,
congratulations, Eric. And again, thank you for being on our program this morning.
Great. It was a real pleasure.
Thanks, okay. Eric. Bye now.
Next up, bye-bye. Cory Doctorow, author of Information Doesn't Want to Be Free, the books on the state of copyright and the creative success in the digital age. You're listening to Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW. I'm John Wells.
I'm Peggy Ijams.
Join us for The Mix Friday morning at 9 a.m.
Folk singer Sherry Call is going to be joining us with Christmas music. Larry Warren, the leader of our KPCW tribe, is going to be in. And Hack Attack will, too, to talk about who knows what.
That's Friday on The Mix at 9 a.m. Brought to you by Utah Olympic Park, Wasatch Brew Pub, and Squatters Roadhouse Grill and Pub.
Nexus IT is proud to have supported KPCW for the past 10 years. Nexus IT provides on-premise and cloud voice over IP, phone systems, and service that simplify and unify your business telecommunications. 435-487-9099, nexusitc.net.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with my co-host John Wells. Our next guest is Cory Doctorow. He's the author of the new book, Information Doesn't Want to Be Free. Doctorow takes on the state of copyright and creative success in the digital age. Can small artists still thrive in the internet era? Can giant record labels avoid alienating their audiences? This is a book about the pitfalls and the opportunities that creative industries and individuals are confronting today, about how the old models have failed or found new footing, and about what might soon replace them. Cory Doctorow is a blogger, he's a writer of science fiction, and a journalist. And Cory, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Hi there, thank you for having me on.
Well, we're delighted to have you. So, you know, I guess I'll start with this, that some people say you're either for copyright or against it. You've sort of been against it, but now you're coming up with a middle ground. So, and apparently people who are familiar with your work may be surprised by this. So talk about that.
Yeah, sure. I think that it's not helpful to try and say whether either you're for or against copyright. Because ultimately, all copyright has ever really been is the industrial regulation of the entertainment industry. The way that we made copyright laws, we said, well, what is it the entertainment industry is doing when they make contracts and when they negotiate among themselves? All right, we'll make that into the law. And the way we'll figure out whether the law applies to you, whether you're in the entertainment industry, is whether you're making or handling a copy of a work. Because that's a pretty good proxy for whether you're doing something industrial before the internet came along. Because every book always had a printing press in its history. But now, because the act of consuming stuff, you know, the reading a book on the internet involves first making a copy of it to your device, we've come up with this crazy idea that that means that we should start applying this really abstract and difficult to understand industrial regulation to something that everybody does. And more than that, something that's become the center of what we do, the single wire that delivers, you know, our free speech and our free press and freedom of association and freedom of assembly and access to education and to social mobility and to better nutrition and health, all those things that we get through the internet. And it's just not suited for that. But that doesn't mean that we can't have a good copyright that regulates the entertainment industry. It just means we should stop telling, you know, 12-year-olds that they have to understand abstract bodies of entertainment law in order to make Harry Potter fan site.
Yeah, that's funny because I do think primarily about the young kids who are growing up with so much technological expertise. It doesn't make sense to them that they can't download music, you know, pirated music for free.
Well, you know, I think that where we've come up with solutions that make it easier for people to get stuff legally and at a price that they feel is reasonable, they've taken advantage of it. Not all of them and not all the time. But, you know, kids have been trying to figure out how to get music for free forever. It's not because they don't have ethics. It's because they really like music and don't have a lot of money.
Yeah.
And so in my day, we tape vinyl records for each other. But pretty consistently, what we find is that the people who download the most illegally are also the people who pay the most and go to the most concerts. Basically, people who do stuff with music a lot do all the things associated with music a lot. They go to the most concerts, and they buy the most bootlegs, and they buy the most regular CDs, and they own vinyl, and they own 78s, and they collect 8-tracks, and they do all the things associated with music. But, you know, as someone who's in the entertainment industry and who earns his living, you know, I feed my family with my copyright. My interest in this is partly making sure that kids growing up today don't think, oh, well, copyright is insane and should be destroyed or abolished, because I actually depend on there being a good copyright that regulates my relationship with the people who invest in my works, with my publishers and so on, and also with the people who they sell through, like Amazon or Apple. And I think we've gotten those rules wrong in a really crazy way, and that's part of what the book is about.
Corey, as far as reading material is concerned, I believe since 1989, you no longer need the letter C enclosed by a circle or notification that your material is copyrighted. Is that correct?
I think it's actually 76. The 76 Copyright Act that kicked that off.
Mm-hmm.
But what's happened since then is we've had a series of copyright laws that have come up, and each one has kind of expanded the scope and the duration of copyright without a lot of evidentiary regard. So, for example, where we've had sampling that started off as legally a gray zone, you had artists making wildly successful albums like It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back and Paul's Boutique, which are, you know, the two best-selling, most profitable hip-hop albums of all time. And they sampled without getting clearance, without paying anyone for it. And at the time, the assumption was, well, you know, in the same way that Duke Ellington might play 6 bars of someone else's song in the middle of a solo, well, Chuck D will drop 3 bars of someone else's groove in the middle of his music, and that it's the same thing. It's fair use. And right. Since then, we've had a body of law and practice that said, really, you need to clear every one of those samples. And what it's done is it's basically eliminated that kind of music. Contemporary music sounds nothing like the sample-heavy music that we had before, with one exception, and that's illegal music that gets played in clubs, whose artists are liable, if they're ever discovered, if their real names are found and if they're sued, they're liable to having everything they own taken away from them. And really, that can't be what copyright's for, right? To eliminate a genre of commercial and critically successful art and make the people who continue to practice it liable to having everything they own taken away from them?
Yeah. And I think there are a lot of people that don't understand when they would be in violation and when they would. For an example, if you save your work, that alone means your work is copyrighted if you save it on the computer.
Well, that's true. You know, once the work is fixed, you get this automatic copyright. But, you know, historically, what we've done is we've said that a whole realm of what people do is not anti-copyright or pro-copyright or against copyright or not against copyright. We just said that it's like outside of the scope of it. So think about like finance law, right? There's a whole bunch of rules about how and when you can loan money. But loaning money to your friend for lunch just kind of doesn't, it's like it's not against the rules for loaning money and it's not for the rules for loaning money. It's just not inside the finance industry. And in the same way, although technically there were a bunch of things that you did that were and weren't interacting with copyright law, it was never enforced. There was never a question of it. It just came up, you know, as a kind of cultural activity that was not, and no one would have claimed with a straight face that you needed to understand copyright law to make sense of those activities.
So, Corey, just a quick question. I'm just curious about this. We're having this conversation now, and sometime later today, we're going to take this conversation, put it up on a podcast, and put it on our website that you can point to, and our listeners can go through the archive and listen at their convenience. Let's say during our conversation, we talk about something that was developed by someone else and is clearly footnoted in your book, but we don't say that during the conversation, and now it's up on the podcast. Could that person, let's say his name is Al, could he come back and say, hey, listen, you guys just infringed on my copyright?
Well, no, because copyright doesn't cover ideas. It only covers expressions. So unless we quoted Al at enormous length, it wouldn't come up at all. That's kind of outside the scope of copyright. And so it wouldn't really arise.
Okay.
That's interesting. So is it that those who are making copyright law are not creative enough or not, you know, their experience in copyright law as it pertains to, a book? Is that what we need? We need more creativity and more innovation within copyright law or what is it?
Well, you know, to be honest, the reason we have dumb copyright law is the same reason we have lots of other kinds of dumb law, and it's that we have self-interested industry lobbyists who basically inform the debate without reference to evidence. And so, you know, a good example, I used to lobby on copyright at the UN, at the World Intellectual Property Organization, and one of the things that comes up a lot there is they'd like to make a treaty that would create a copyright over databases, things that aren't creative works, but are non-original facts, like phone books. The phone books are not copyrightable. Even if you put a lot of work into making a phone book, I can take that photocopy book for that phone book and sell it as my own, because copyright only covers creativity. And in Europe, they actually created this kind of database copyright. And what happened was that the European database industry stagnated, while in America, where they don't have this kind of copyright, it grew 25-fold in 20 years. But the people who invest in non-original databases still want a database right in the U.S. They lobby really, really hard for it. And we often see the U.S. Trade Representative speaking out in favor of it at the U.N., because there's any evidence to support that this would make the American industry bigger or stronger. In fact, the evidence is totally to the contrary. It's just because they've got bad lobbying. What we need from our lawmakers would be ideally three reforms. The first one would be a really simple fix to the law about digital locks or digital rights management. This is the anti-copying stuff in your music and movies. Mm-hmm. And the way the law is structured now, it says that if Amazon sells you a Kindle book, like my book for the Kindle, and they put Amazon's lock on it, that only Amazon can authorize you to take the lock off, which is what you need to do if you want to read it with equipment that doesn't come from Amazon, with a program that doesn't come from Amazon. Okay. And that's silly, because it's my copyright. It's not Amazon's copyright. All they did was wrap it up and sell it to you. And what that does is that the more books of mine Amazon sells, the more my customers have locked into Amazon's platform, and the harder it is for me to tell Amazon, I'm sorry, your deal's not good enough, we're not going to sell through you anymore, we're just going to sell through the competition. And so all you need to do to fix that is just say, well, the copyright holder can authorize you to unlock your book. That would be such an easy fix.
Okay.
In the case of the way that we're handling what's called intermediary liability, this is where we say to companies like Amazon or Google that all of the material that gets uploaded that you make public, like all the videos on YouTube, you have a responsibility to take it down. You have this ever-increasing set of responsibilities, like if you're PayPal, to make sure that you're not processing transactions for pirates. All this does is reduce the number of companies like Amazon that there are, because it becomes more and more expensive to start a company like Amazon, you know, or YouTube. It used to be that if you wanted to start YouTube, you need some hard drives, but now you need an army of lawyers and their content ID database of all the copyrighted video ever to try and prevent piracy. And what that means is that instead of having lots and lots of companies like YouTube competing for my business that I can use as a way to get more money out of my publishers or out of the studios or the labels by saying, look, if you don't give me a good enough deal, I'm going out there and I'm going to go on my own. Look at all these competing companies trying to get my business. What it does is it makes the new boss just the same as the old boss. And there's only a few video hosts. They all end up very cozy with the labels and with the studios, like YouTube is now, where YouTube just did a streaming audio deal to do a Spotify-style service with the major labels. And after they did that deal, they went to the independent labels and they said, you're going to take the deal that the majors negotiated. And if you don't like it, you can't put your video on YouTube anymore. And so you end up with, without enough competition, you make it harder for me to negotiate for more money out of my publisher. So again, a really easy fix, what we say to these people, to these companies is, actually, just like it's not the phone company's job to make sure that you're not planning a bank robbery, it's not your job to police copyright. That's someone else's job. And then finally, the thing that we really need to fix is we need to say, look, the internet is not a glorified video on demand service. It's the nervous system of the 21st century. And when we regulate the internet, we need to approach it with the gravitas that it deserves. Not like it's a way to get pornography or recruit jihadis, but like it's the single wire that delivers all of your access to culture, commerce, ideas, and family. And we shouldn't be making these rules just for one industry or one interest group. We should be considering them with a really evidence-led, very somber approach. And that's not what we get at all in internet law.
Wow, that is just fascinating. And I totally see what you're saying. But then where is the middle ground that prevents the nervous system of our time from recruiting jihadis, for example? I mean,
Well, I don't know that there is a way to stop people from talking to each other to recruit one another using whatever technology there is. I mean, I think since our first and oldest group-forming technology, which is language, was created, people have used it to do bad things. Yeah. I think it's probably asking too much of regulation to say we must figure out a way, you know, just like we've never said, oh, well, you know, every bank robber is driving away on a car with four wheels on it. We'd make a bank robbery proof car. You know, the fact that all jihadis use the way that everybody talks to each other to recruit one another is not surprising. And it doesn't say anything about the internet being uniquely suited as a jihadi recruiting tool. It just means that it's how we all talk to each other now. And just like the wheel has this general purpose character that is broadly useful to everyone, and you would do enormous violence to it if you try to make it incapable of aiding people to do bad things. In the same way, the internet just does so much for us. And, you know, not only would it be ineffective to try to make a jihadi-proof internet, but the side damage, the damage to the innocent parties as a consequence of surveilling and censoring the internet is so great that, you know, it should be a non-starter to begin with.
Our guest is Cory Doctorow. He's the best-selling author of the science fiction book Little Brother and its follow-up. Homeland. There we go.
Yeah.
both great books, and now the author of the book Information Doesn't Want to Be Free: Laws for the Internet Age.
Cory, I was preparing for today's conversation, reading your book, bumped into a friend yesterday afternoon. Told me an interesting story. He received a hard copy letter in the mail saying that he had violated a copyright of a picture. They sent some screenshots as well, and they asked him for $840. His company is very careful about where they get their pictures from, so he kind of looked into it and that sort of thing. Gave him a call on the phone, and within 2 or 3 minutes was able to get the $840 down to $120. He's telling me this story, and I'm thinking, what a great opportunity for a scam. And I Googled copyright scams, and there's only 1,400,000 entries. And there's one story after another on all of these copyright scams. What a business, huh?
Well, in fact, if you Googled copyright troll, which is what we call those people, that's the term of art for those people, you would have found lots more than $1.4 million. And it really is a really profitable scam, partly because the statutory damages for violating copyright are so high, you know, to $150,000 in damages and $250,000 in fines per act of infringement, that a lot of the time, if people send you a threat that is, you know, sort of below the level where it's worth you talking to a lawyer, you'll cave. But, you know, the real risk isn't what happens when someone falsely accuses you of being guilty. the real risk is that we're all kind of guilty because copyright law forbids so many things that we do in the normal course of activity, that we're all guilty presumptively, and that opens the door to a kind of selective enforcement. And the most egregious example of this was that there was a kid at Swarthmore College who maintained a piece of open source software, free software called Flatland, that was just a search engine, just like Google. And what it did is, instead of looking around the web and indexing the files it found, it looked around your local network and indexed the files that it found. So, you know, you would use it on your campus network to make a list of all the files people were sharing, all the PowerPoint decks and all of the papers and all of the recordings of people's lectures and so on. But because it's a campus network, it's also got other stuff on it. It's got pirated music and movies and games and whatever. You know, so does Google, right? A search engine is a search engine. It's not illegal to make a search engine. But the Recording Industry Association of America went after this kid. And what they went after him for was file sharing, was for having music on his computer that he hadn't paid for. And the reason they knew that he had it is because he was a university student. And all university students have hard drives full of things that they're not supposed to have. And because the damages were so high, right, because the threat that he faced was so intense, you know, all the money he had, all the money his parents had, all the money he would ever earn, what they demanded of him was, we will settle with you, but you're going to have to switch majors because we don't want people like you getting degrees in computer science, right? People who are making legal software.
Was that Aaron Schwartz?
No, that wasn't Aaron. Aaron helped me on that book, Homeland. This was another kid. What happened was, the group I used to work with, Electronic Frontier Foundation, which is sort of like the ACLU of the internet, EFF went to bat for this kid and frankly embarrassed the record industry so much that they backed off from their demand. But this is the kind of risk that we face when everyone is presumptively guilty of a crime, especially when children are presumptively guilty of a crime.
Yeah.
When everyone breaks the law, it tells you something about the law's suitableness for being on the statute books.
Yeah. Wow. Corey, we've run out of time here, but this is so fascinating. This is, you know what, this is a really great book for college students to read, isn't it? You know, they're kind of more in this age than maybe some of us and John and my generation, but very good.
Yeah, I should hope so. And can I mention also that I've just done an independent audiobook of it that Will Wheaton, who used to be on Star Trek and who's now on Big Bang Theory, he read it for me. And so you can get that without any digital rights management. You can get it on my website or on downpour.com. If you Google "information doesn't want to be free audiobook," you'll find it.
Corey, I wish we had more time. Is it possible to answer this question quickly? If you have any, Park City, we've got a great music scene here. Do you have any advice to aspiring musicians on how to make money in the sea of madness?
You know, it is a kind of short answer, and the trick is in the details, but the short answer is, people have only ever made money in about a half a dozen ways in the arts. You know, you make something that that people can buy, or you make something that's kind of like what you do that people can buy, like a T-shirt, or you give performance, or you look for patrons. And so now we used to have to please a duke or a king, and now we have things like Kickstarter and Patreon.
Yeah.
There's really only a half a dozen of these things, and the details change depending on the technology. And most people who try most things in the arts will fail. I mean, that's been true since, you know, caveman days. But the actual details have not changed, but the actual shape of the industry has not changed a lot, you know, in thousands of years.
Mm-hmm. The book is "Information Doesn't Want to Be Free: Laws for the Internet Age," and our guest, Corey Doctorow. Thank you so much for joining us today, Corey.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Corey.
And we'll be right back.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery. We know what grows. ParkCityNursery.com. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
I want to thank our guests today, Corey Doctorow and Eric Idy. Also thank our sponsors, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, Peak Art and Frame, and Nexus IT.